This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Eric Duplass, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. Eric spearheads Sightline's work on energy policy. He has published more than 200 articles, reports, and analyses on a range of issues connected to fossil fuel transport, including carbon emissions, local pollution, transportation system impacts, rail policy, and economics. Eric Duplass is here today to give us an update on oil transport by rail in the Pacific Northwest and to evaluate the implications for climate change. Welcome, Eric.
Well, thanks for having me on, Diane.
Would you like to begin by saying a few words about Sightline Institute?
Sure. Sightline Institute is a regional think tank. We're based here in Seattle. We work in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia on a range of issues connected to sustainability. So that includes housing affordability, it includes governance reform, lots of questions about economics. And my particular slice of the pie is about climate policy and energy policy.
Remind us of why transport of oil by rail through the Pacific Northwest is of concern.
Well, it's a big concern for long-term environmental impacts like climate change, but also because moving oil by rail is an extremely dangerous way to move oil. And what we've seen borne out in the last 2.5 years, is that these trains derail and explode catastrophically, in one case killing 47 people. So this is something new in the industry, and it's something quite threatening, I think, to the region.
How much oil is currently being transported by rail through the Pacific Northwest? What is the status?
You know, it's surprisingly difficult to get an accurate read on exactly how much oil is moving at any time. What we do know is that we have enough capacity built to handle about 300,000 or 400,000 barrels per day, which is a lot of oil. What we also know is that the industry hopes to expand that capacity to handle more than 1 million barrels per day, which is way more than we can consume in this region. So what we're seeing is an expansion of an industry that didn't exist in 2012. It's already expanded quite a lot, and it stands to triple, basically, from where it is now.
How does the amount of oil being transported by rail through the Pacific Northwest at present compare to the amount of oil by rail in the U.S. as a whole, just roughly?
Well, in very rough terms, we are about 25% of the industry. So if you think about the continent-wide movements of oil trains, you know, the big story is moving light shale oil out of the Bakken Formation in North Dakota. About 25% of it goes to the Gulf Coast. Maybe half of it goes to the Mid-Atlantic region, so Delaware, Philly area. And then another quarter of it comes our way into Washington State.
As we've spoken about before, a number of oil terminals are being proposed along the coast of the Pacific Northwest. Why are the oil terminals being proposed?
You know, the story with the oil by rail industry is similar to the story we've seen with coal export, similar to the story we've seen with natural gas and other fossil fuels. And the story is basically this. We are victims of our geography, in the sense that we are pinched between these huge reserves of coal, oil, and gas in the middle of North America and some of the world's fastest growing energy markets in Asia. And because of the economics and because of the logistics of moving these products, it turns out that the oil and coal and gas industries have to move this stuff through the Pacific Northwest if it's going to find a market. If they can't move it through our region, it's not going to find a market. And so that's why Washington State's water bodies have been targeted for port terminals to take oil trains and then load that oil onto vessels that will presumably move it elsewhere.
Would you give an overview of the terminals being proposed?
Sure. So, you know, if you think about sort of the three major kind of port water bodies for Washington State, we have the Puget Sound, we have Grays Harbor, and then we have the Lower Columbia River. Puget Sound has 5 refineries on it. All of those are slated to take oil trains or already are receiving oil trains. At Grays Harbor, we have a trio of proposals to take oil trains. One of those actually just sort of unwound itself, and one of those projects has now said that they're not going to continue pursuing the receipt of getting permits to receive crude oil trains, which is a huge win. And then on the Lower Columbia River, we have at least 2 operating sites and 2 more under proposal right now. And one of those would be the largest such facility anywhere in North America, maybe the largest in the world. It's very, very big.
Let's talk about the climate change implications of oil by rail in the Pacific Northwest and the proposed terminals. Last November, Sightline released a report it commissioned titled Tracking Emissions, the Climate Impact of the Proposed Crude by Rail Terminals in the Pacific Northwest. If built, how would the proposed terminals affect oil trains and shipping of oil?
Yeah, so what we did, because this is a hotly debated question about whether or not if you build these terminals, will the trains come and how does it change total oil flows? Does it increase consumption or does it just shuffle the deck a little bit? So we went out and hired some industry experts, some technical experts who have studied the oil industry closely for decades. And what they found is that it does matter. if you build new oil infrastructure, whether it's new pipelines or new oil by rail terminals, the net result of that, when you factor in everything else, prices and consumption and global oil flows, the net result is that new infrastructure leads to more consumption, which doesn't sound like rocket science, but it's actually, it's an important thing to prove, because what it proves is that by preventing the construction of new infrastructure, we prevent growth of the oil industry and we help lock carbon in the ground where it belongs.
To what extent might the new Pacific Northwest rail terminals affect the expansion of tar sands development?
That's a great question. It's a hotly debated one. So right now, almost all of the oil trains coming to the Pacific Northwest carry an oil that is very, very different from the tar sands. It's a light, volatile shale oil that comes from deep formations way underground. There's a lot of oil in western North Dakota that looks like that. There is 10 or 20 times as much oil locked in Alberta and in the Canadian tar sands, and that's a heavy, sticky, dense, viscous oil. It's very toxic. It's very energy intensive to extract and process this stuff. That's the oil that was scheduled for the Keystone XL pipeline before that pipeline got shut down. So the question that we've been wrestling with and that others have been wondering about is whether or not, in the absence of new pipelines like Keystone, does oil by rail become the fallback option? And what the analysis found is the answer is yes, is that it will put pressure on the Canadian oil producers of that heavy, dense, bitumen-like materials, which they call it, to move that stuff in some way, and it will be by rail. So we'll be the next chapter in that fight. They lost their first best option, but we're going to have to deal with some of the consequences of that.
How might the amount of fracking be affected by new terminals?
It depends on a lot of different factors, but new terminals would generally, if we build them, would increase the amount of fracking. What I've been referring to on this program is shale oil. It's basically oil that's trapped in shale formations deep underground, a mile or two underground. And we've known it's been there for a long time, but it wasn't until fracking technology and horizontal drilling really took off in 2010, 2011, that we really began to extract that stuff in volume. So by building oil train terminals, we actually sort of incent the upstream use of fracking to get at that oil, because there's no other real way to get at that oil in an economical fashion other than with fracking.
How would greenhouse gas emissions be affected if new terminals are built?
Well, the answer is that it would increase greenhouse gas emissions. We don't know the exact magnitude of the increase, but we have, through our technical experts that we hired, been able to estimate that the equivalent is something like 9 to 22 million new cars on an annual basis. Roughly speaking, building new oil by rail infrastructure in Washington State would increase climate emissions by adding, 20 million cars to the world. That's a lot.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. Our topic is oil transport by rail in the Pacific Northwest and the implications for climate change. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener power at KEXP 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. What are the economics of oil by rail to the Pacific Northwest compared to other oil transport methods?
The economics question is exactly the right question to ask, because ultimately it's the economics that drives oil flows and oil consumption, not just in the Northwest, but globally. And so what we find is out of western North Dakota and even out of the Alberta tar sands, it is as cheap or cheaper to rail that product to the Northwest than it is to rail it elsewhere or to put it in a pipeline and take it elsewhere. Now, historically, that hasn't really mattered because there aren't that many consumers in the Pacific Northwest. We're not a hugely populous region. We're not the Gulf Coast. We're not the Mid-Atlantic. We're not New York. What's happened now, especially with the ending of what's referred to as the export ban on crude oil, we can become a throughput region for other places. So if it's cheap to get it by rail to the Pacific Northwest, then they can use the Northwest as sort of a gateway where they can open up into markets in California, into Pacific markets, into China and other places abroad. So we stand to become sort of a throughput center, highway of crude oil moving from the interior of the continent to markets elsewhere.
How likely is it that oil transport to Asia would be the likely outcome?
Well, it all depends on prices. At current prices, which are extremely low, the chances of that happening are very small. If prices rebound to levels where they were just a year and a half ago, then the chances are pretty good. And if we look forward 2, 3, 4 years, and there are a range of price forecasts out there, and there are credible, intelligent people who make arguments everywhere along that range. But if you look at the high end of those ranges, if oil prices go back up to 100, 150 bucks a barrel, let's say, even at 100 bucks a barrel, I think it is extremely likely, and this is borne out with analytical evidence, that we would see crude oil offshored through the Pacific Northwest and served to markets on the Pacific Rim. But there are a lot of complexities in that, and it depends a lot on what's going on in those other economies as well.
Earlier, you outlined the terminals that are being proposed. Which of the terminals are of most concern?
Well, by far the most concerning is this project I mentioned earlier. It's on the Lower Columbia River at Vancouver, Washington. It's proposed by a big Texas oil company called Tesoro. And they would serve about 360,000 barrels per day out of that site. They would take it by train, load it onto vessels, and then take it out the mouth of the Columbia. They have set that site up to handle light oil as well as the heavy Canadian tar sands. They're an extremely aggressive, politically active company. They play hardball, and they have done everything they can to steamroll that community. It hasn't been working for them so far, but they're a very dangerous player.
What are the findings of the environmental impact statement for this terminal?
Where we are with that project is we have now seen what's called the draft environmental impact statement. So that's the first round of analysis of what the terminal would mean. The draft analysis shows that they expect there to be derailments of oil trains, which can lead to catastrophic fires. They expect there to be traffic delays and congestions. There's a serious risk of spills, both at the terminal site and from inbound trains and from outbound vessels. And when you add all that stuff up, plus other risk factors that are connected with moving oil trains, it just looks like a dead loser economically. I mean, forget about the environmental questions for a moment. Just think about the economics of it. And this is something that the city of Vancouver, Washington has woken up to in a big way. This is horrible for their economy. They don't want this there. In fact, the City Council of Vancouver, Washington, which is not, all things considered, a particularly sort of progressive or left-leaning city council, they have voted unanimously and unequivocally twice, not only that they opposed the oil-by-rail infrastructure project, but that they put a moratorium on any future plans to develop oil-by-rail there. They really feel like they got screwed by their port commission, kind of under cover of darkness, before they had a chance to stop it.
Who will decide whether the terminal can go forward?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. Because the project is so big, it operates under a special sort of regulatory process. And that process will take the proposal ultimately to Governor Inslee's desk, or the governor's desk, I should say, whoever the governor is at the time when it's ready for a decision. And the governor is the sole decision maker. So the governor will either say, yes, we approve it, no, we don't approve it, or will sometimes condition the approval based on meeting certain needs. So with respect to the politics of the decision making, really the buck does stop at the governor's desk.
What is the timeline for the decision to be made?
That's a great question. Now, Tesoro thought they would begin moving loaded oil trains into an already constructed site by now. And their timeline has slipped and slipped and slipped like it has for all these projects. Their costs have skyrocketed. They're up 150%, I think, beyond where they started. I fully expect that their timeline will continue to slip. I don't think they'll have a finished proposal probably until 2017. They think it's going to be middle of this year, but given all the flaws we see with the draft environmental impact statement, given the ferocity of the advocates opposed to this project and a bunch of other factors, I would be shocked if we saw it before 2017.
In addition to the Vancouver City Council, who else is opposed to the terminal?
Well, who's not opposed to the terminal at this point? I mean, right now we have commercial and recreational fishermen who have come out swinging against it. The tribes hate it. The neighborhood groups in Vancouver, Washington can't stand it. Obviously, the environmental groups statewide in both Oregon and Washington loathe the project. Longshoremen have come out against it. So labor is against it. The business community is largely against it. One of the biggest real estate developers in the region has been planning a big walkable waterfront redevelopment of some of Vancouver's industrial land. It would be very good both for the kind of culture, but also for the economy of Vancouver. He's viciously opposed to this project because it's going to mess up his plans and kind of his ambitions for the city. And so right now, the alignment, the constellation of folks against this is so huge that there's almost hard to find anybody who's for it, who's not getting paid by the project. Spokane's against it, for that matter. Spokane, hundreds of miles away, will see all of the oil trains going and coming from this site. And so the folks there, I mean, they look at these kind of projects and they think, we get all the downside, all the risk, and no benefit whatsoever. Why would we want this?
What are the chances for stopping the terminal?
I think the chances are very high. And they're high because the projects are terrible ideas. And so it's incumbent, I think, on the folks who study this stuff and who participate in the review process just to make clear how badly flawed these projects are and how negatively they impact the region. And you know, my particular concern with the world is mostly about climate change and environmental impacts, but there are lots of folks who have other concerns, and those concerns are totally legitimate. People don't want to be stuck in traffic waiting for a super long oil train to pass. People don't want their salmon fisheries messed up. I get that. Longshoremen don't want to have the harbor closed down because of an oil spill. I get that. And so what we need to make clear is that big fossil fuel infrastructure like this creates so many harms for so many people in so many different ways that it just doesn't make any sense for our way of life.
The 40-year ban on crude oil exports was just lifted last month. What led to the ban being lifted?
What led to the ban being lifted is that our democracy is fundamentally corrupted and that the oil industry has way too much influence. I know that sounds like a little bit of an offbeat or cheap answer, but the oil industry cannot fight us nowadays in a public setting. When they have to come to Vancouver, Washington, or to the Pacific Northwest and have a debate in public, they lose those arguments almost every time nowadays. Where they have a lot of influence still is in Congress. And what they were able to do within a shockingly short period of time, we did not expect it to be coming this fast, they were able to overturn a 40-year-old ban on exporting American crude oil. It was a ban that was set up for conservation and for energy independence. They steamrolled Congress during the budget negotiations and got that ban lifted so that now they can take American crude and without refining it, without doing anything to it, manufacturing it at all, they can just offshore it to markets abroad. It's a big win for the industry, a big loss for environmental considerations and for labor too.
How will the lifting of the ban on crude oil exports affect the potential for oil transport through the Northwest?
You know, again, it's a question of price. If prices stay low, it won't have a big impact. When prices get high again, it could have a very big impact. And, you know, the sort of worst case reasonable scenario is that prices rebound to a level that they were in 2013, 2014. We get a commodity price spike of some kind. And the Pacific Northwest, Columbia River and Puget Sound basically become super highways for crude oil. And we start to look more like Houston or Galveston, but on the Pacific. And that would have, I think, very negative consequences for the things that people care about in this region.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM, by mobile app, and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Eric Duplass, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. Our topic is oil transport by rail in the Pacific Northwest and the implications for climate change. Last November, President Obama rejected the Keystone Pipeline. What is your perspective on the importance of the Keystone Pipeline rejection?
Well, it was huge, and it was super consequential. What that pipeline would have done, for folks who may not know the specifics of it, is it was a very large pipeline that would have taken oil from the tar sands in Alberta and delivered it to some transport centers and refining hubs on the Gulf Coast. That would have unlocked a huge amount of some of the world's dirtiest and most destructive oil. It also became a litmus test for his environmental credibility and for the oil industry's strength. We were able, the environmental movement was able to make that a public fight, and we tend to win in public fights when there's a robust long-term discussion about these questions. He rejected it. It was a big, big win. Subsequent to him rejecting that, though, there were two other pipelines in British Columbia that people in the United States don't think about as much, but they would have basically built pipelines to take that oil out of Alberta and move it to the Pacific. And now both of those pipelines were sort of treated as alternatives to Keystone, and both of them now are under very serious threat. One of them is probably dead already, and the other one is getting close to dead. And nobody believed this stuff was possible. Nobody believed it was possible to beat those pipelines 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And what's happened is, as the environmental community has helped nourish this broad opposition effort that includes a lot of folks who have a lot of different interests, we have seen that even the most well-capitalized, dangerous projects by the most profitable industry on the planet cannot stand up to public opposition.
You mentioned a bit about this earlier, but how does Keystone compare to the importance of oil by rail in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, you know, it's a big deal. And people who spent the last few years fighting Keystone correctly believe that Keystone is a very big deal. It would have carried about 830,000 barrels per day. In Washington State and very closely adjoining regions of Oregon and BC, but basically in Washington State alone, we have proposals to carry 1 million barrels a day by rail into just this state. So just the oil by rail in Washington is actually on a volumetric basis, bigger than Keystone XL. So what's happening in the Pacific Northwest is of huge consequence. If you factor in the coal export terminals, liquefied natural gas, methanol, you name it, I keep going. I mean, you can tell a plausible analytical story about Oregon and Washington and British Columbia that we are 5, 6, 7 times as carbon intense in terms of the proposals that we're considering now as the Keystone XL pipeline. So what's happening in the Northwest is of huge global consequence in terms of the climate.
What are the prospects of oil transport through the Pacific Northwest at this point?
What's happening right now is we've got several of our refineries in the North Sound, both up north of Bellingham at Ferndale and at Anacortes, that now have the permitted capability of receiving oil trains. They have been moving some trains to those sites. We think the numbers of those trains are declining now or will decline in the future. But the sharp point of the fight right now is about whether we're going to continue to build out port terminal sites, basically. So these sites at Grace Harbor, the sites in the lower Columbia River, and some additional sites on Puget Sound, to enlarge the capacity. And if we build those sites, we are going to see, you know, up to 14 trains a day carrying loaded crude oil, plus the empties returning, which would be a huge change. You know, if you go back to summer of 2012, there were no oil trains. There were none. So this is something new under the sun.
So you have been an expert witness in the Delta 5 trial. Would you like to tell us about the trial and what your perspective is on what's going on there?
Yes. So just yesterday, I testified on behalf of the defense in what's being called the Delta 5 trial. The Delta 5 were five climate activists who, in September of 2014, went into the Everett rail yards, the Delta rail yards there, and for 8 hours, they blockaded an oil train. They were subsequently arrested, and they're being tried now for trespassing and for blocking a train. And what they are doing is invoking what's called the necessity defense. And the necessity defense is a provision in common law and in the statutory laws of many states that there are times when it's permissible to break the law to serve a greater good. So the analogy that people often use is if you trespassed in a building to rescue someone who was about to be consumed by a fire in the building, you wouldn't usually convict that person of trespassing because they were doing something that was more important. And so the question is blocking an oil train in the Everett rail yards, is that sufficient to meet the criteria of a necessity defense? And that's the argument. So I was on the stand yesterday making the case that there is a very real, imminent, and serious danger from these oil trains in the Northwest. And we'll find out very soon whether or not the jury believes that.
Would you say more about what the atmosphere was like in the courtroom?
It was pretty neat to see. I had a great time there. The courtroom was absolutely packed. They had brought in extra chairs. It was so full that there were people out in the halls. There were five cameras there, TV cameras and documentary film crews. So there's a lot of attention on it right now. The print media was there. The judge is paying very close attention. He's taking the arguments very seriously. This is not theater. This is not a circus. This is a serious judicial proceeding. He's taking it very seriously. The jury was paying very close attention. They were taking notes during my entire testimony, during the testimony of others. And so they are really, in Snohomish County, taking very seriously the notion that blocking an oil train could be very much the same thing as trespassing in a burning building to rescue somebody. Because what those activists were doing is trying to rescue us all from the threat both of climate change over the long term and of explosions and spills in the near term.
What is the timeline for finishing the trial?
The trial is supposed to be wrapped up this week. We think testimony will probably conclude today. Today's Thursday that we're taping this program. And we don't know how long the jury will deliberate, but we would probably expect to have an answer, you know, by next week.
So what do you see as the upcoming threats from fossil fuels that will be of the most concern?
The way I like to describe this is as a tsunami with three waves. And the first wave of the tsunami was coal export terminals. The proposal started arriving in 2011, 2012. Those are dying now. They're not quite dead, and we need to continue fighting them. The second wave was oil by rail. Like I said, 1 million barrels per day scheduled for the Northwest. We're in the thick of that fight now. The third wave of that tsunami is going to be basically fracked fuels and petrochemicals. And that's going to be huge quantities of natural gas coming out of the American and Canadian Rockies, and then taking that stuff to sites of the ports where they would be liquefied and exported to Asia, or in some cases taken to places like Tacoma or on the Columbia River, where the natural gas will be converted into petrochemicals like methanol. Very water intensive, potentially very carbon intensive, and then shipped to China to make plastics. And so what we'll be seeing in 2016, 2017 are big debates over whether we're going to become a big petrochemical export center that would use fossil fuels to help China basically develop its economy. That's going to be a really hot fight.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, you know, the big message is twofold. It's one that there are few places in the world that are as important to the climate fight right now as the Pacific Northwest. What's happening here is of absolutely global consequence. Number two, recent history has shown that public opposition can beat back the most dangerous proposals by the best-funded industries on the planet. And we can win. Right now, we're driving coal companies into bankruptcy that 5 years ago said they were going to steamroll us. We can win all of these fights in the Northwest.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Eric.
Thank you, Diane. I appreciate the opportunity.
You were just listening to Eric DePlace, Policy Director for Sightline Institute. For more information, check on the web at sightline.org. Again, that's sightline.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening. And be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM by mobile app and at kexp.org.